So one of the things that interests me is, I don't even want to call it an interplay between Chumash, Tanakh, and literature, because it's not literature per se, but on the other hand, to what extent can we ignore certain literary devices or literary, let's call them themes or tools or ideas? So I'm not exclusively looking at it as I would any other piece of literature that you read, but tools that we use, I want to use as well. But I'm getting to a larger point. And that larger point is when people actually learn Torah, when they learn Chumash, how do they go about doing it? And do they look, sometimes they get hyper-focused on one word, or an extreme application of that would be getting hyper-focused even on one letter, sometimes one verse, sometimes a parsha, and so on. But to a very great extent, I want to look at the book of Shmot as a book. So obviously, just starting off at the very beginning, I'm not going to discuss the entire book as a book, but I am looking at this as a new book, which means we just finished another book, and part of what we need to understand is to what extent is this book a continuation of the old book, and to what extent is this book a completely new work? And the answer over here is that both of those elements are true, and that's part of what I want to try to get at today, is namely to see how the narrative continues, how we are going from where we were, that's one hand, and on the other hand, and how we suddenly find ourselves in, again, this completely new book. And over here I'm adding one more issue. Once we realize or appreciate it's a new book, then part of my question is going to be, to what extent is this new book, well, let me rephrase that, how does this new book compare and contrast to the old book? So now, again, I want to be really clear about this. We could just start Sefer Shmot by itself and start reading. We could. You don't lose anything. But even though I said you don't lose anything, there's going to be certain elements of understanding that will only become visible once we compare this to the book of Bereshit. So therefore, what I'm saying, what we're going to do today is really two things which are not contradictory. One is to see Shmot as it continues the story, the narrative from Sefer Bereshit. And the other is to see how it's radically different from Sefer Bereshit. And that's really what I think is more interesting. So as far as seeing this as a continuation, God made a covenant with Abraham. The covenant was the most important prophecy in the book of Bereshit. That prophecy is the Brit Bein HaBetarim. The Brit Bein HaBetarim said the Jews are chosen. It says that Avram is chosen. It says that the land of Israel will one day be theirs, but, and there's always this but, it's the fine print, it's the price that you pay. And the price that they're going to pay for this incredible gift is that they are going to be enslaved, which is a land which isn't theirs, for 400 years. By the way, that's a maximum. These things are always negotiable afterwards, but that's a maximum. They're going to be enslaved for 400 years, and then they're going to come be set free. And really rapidly, when this book begins, the Jews find themselves in the type of an exile which I don't think they necessarily understood was even possible when Avraham forges this covenant with God, or God forges the covenant with Avraham, which means suddenly they find themselves in a situation which is not only one of servitude, but it's also a situation where a very threat to their existence, their lives, has been introduced. And by the way, that's very easy to say. That wasn't part of the brochure. That was not, no, whoever said anything about taking kids and throwing them into the Nile. God never said that to Abraham. And one of the things that we will constantly need to do as we proceed is to take a look to what extent what is taking place now is, or how it compares and contrasts to what it is that Avraham said, or what God said to Avraham. Sefer Shmot, the book of Shmot, begins, whole generation has died. We no longer have that first generation. I mean, obviously, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, obviously, all of them are gone. But not just then. We're told very quickly, very rapidly, in the first couple of verses, that all the children of Yaakov have now died. So now we're left to a new generation, and very quickly it's going to be a generation that was born in servitude, born out of the land, where the land of Israel is only a dream or a memory, which, by the way, to a very great extent, is really the Jewish experience for the most part of history. For the most part of history, Jews were not born in the land of Israel. For the most part of history, Jews inherited a dream, inherited a promise, inherited feelings which are completely irrational towards a land on the other end of the world, which for the most part they've never seen, never visited, only imagine what it was like. Every time I read a description, let's say, for example, of Rashi describing something about the geography of the land of Israel, I think how hard he must have worked in order to try to figure something out that I can open up my window and I can look at. And I'm saying literally, I can open up my window and I can look at. And he had to try to work and try to understand. And, you know, I don't know if he had maps or tradition or what he's doing, but just think how hard they're working. But there's a love. I mean, it's like falling in love with somebody who you never met. But you know that they're there and you know that they exist and you know that you want to meet them and you know you want to live with them. But as I said, it's completely irrational. But that's this love which exists. Nonetheless, that's how our book begins, falling very, very deep into this exile. The rabbis, by the way, have a term for this, which is mostly found in Kabbalistic sources, and that is that the Jews fell to the 49th level of Tum'ah. They fell and they fell and they fell, not just into servitude, but it's interesting, you know, how do you call idolatry in Hebrew? It's called Avodah Zarah. So when the Jews were going to be enslaved, it's understood theologically that the slavery is not just one of a physical slavery, but it's also a slavery which is going to be a theological slavery, because they're going to be in an environment where trying to believe and to hold on to belief in a monotheistic God within this polytheistic society is going to be really quite challenging. And by the way, at that point, I'm leaving now, because that's going to be far more important as we move into the plagues, B'li Neder, next week and the week afterwards, and understand what the plagues really were, because as of right now, we don't really understand what they were. But just realize the Jews fell in every single way. And I could completely understand if somebody would have given up, if somebody would have said, the life of a slave is a life of a monotonous, difficult existence with no hope. Any of you who are feeling that way because you're locked up in your rooms or you're locked up on campus and so on, there's one big difference over here. Maybe monotonous, maybe day after day, but there is hope. And the difference is knowing, okay, it's not a week, then it's going to be 2 weeks. If it's not 2 weeks, it'll be a month. If it's not a month, it'll be 2 months. But we do know that this is going to come to an end at some point. And the belief or the understanding or the feeling of that end is something which is itself liberating. But on the other hand, when you're a slave, how easy was it for them to forget? Well, just don't worry. Another 400 years from now, we'll be out of here. And it'll be free. That's a long time. So now let's start all over again. Paro makes this decree that as soon as the Jewish boys are born, that they should be executed, they should be killed. We're told, however, that there are these women who are facilitating the births, and then there's a really important turn of phrase which is used there. It says, Vatir'ena, that they had fear. Vatir enna hamiyodot et elokim. They had a fear of God. V'loasu asher diber leim melech mitzrayim. Vatichayen et eladim. They became agents of life instead of agents of death. And I have to pause there for a moment. Right before this, we read something which now, hopefully, a little bit of my introduction will make sense. Right before this, we're told of Nei Yisrael, paru v'yishritzu v'yirbu v'yatzmu ma'od Ma'od, but to Malay Aritzatam. That phrase, Peru v'yishritzu v'yirbu, should sound like some type of an echo from the verses in early Bereshit. That was the first blessing that was given to mankind, the blessing of Peruvu. So when I said that we need to compare and contrast the beginning of Shmo and the beginning of Bereshit, so Bereshit is a blessing to multiply, and over here there's a reality of multiplying. However, we can now pause and say, what kind of reality of this, of multiplying, is multiplying into a life which could end immediately? Paro's then response to the lack of people listening to him, they fear God, and I have to pause there a moment as well. Was there anybody in Bereshit who were told feared God? Well, Avraham, we're told about this after the Akedah. The other person who feared God is also going to create a little bit of irony, which is absolutely going to be the continuation that I spoke about earlier. Again, two points that we're focusing on at the same time. To what extent is this book a new book? To what extent it's a continuation of the old book? As a new book, how does it compare to the old book? As a continuation, what themes do we see being continued? The first hint at a continuation is we're told the whole generation dies off, but there's one character whose name comes up a number of times here, and that character is Yosef. It says, Ve'akam melech hadash ha-Mitzrayim. There's a new king, new book, new king, new pharaoh. Asher lo yadat Yosef. He didn't know who Yosef was. And I have to ask myself, how in the world is this possible that this man does not know Yosef? Yosef changed and saved the Egyptian economy. What Yosef did, the role of Yosef was one that it's almost impossible for me to believe or understand that here's somebody who doesn't know who Yosef is. By the way, it doesn't say he doesn't remember Yosef, like the Sar HaMashkim, right, the wine steward. It says instead, doesn't know Yosef. The word Yada is going to be one of the key words that's going to be used throughout the redemption process. Knowledge. Yada. Knowledge. By the way, those of you may remember in the very beginning of Bereshit, we also have knowledge. We have a tree of knowledge. An Eitz Hadat Tov V'Ra. We have a sin which takes place because of knowledge. Death comes into the world because of knowledge. Over here, we have death is about to come into the world against Yosef's people because this new king doesn't know who Yosef is. On a rational and maybe even on a historic level, I could put forth a theory, maybe Egypt was overrun by other forces from outside, hostile takeover of the Egyptian society, and maybe this new king knows nothing about Yosef, owes him nothing, knows nothing about him, and therefore it's a whole new beginning. Nonetheless, as I said, Yosef was the major figure at the very end of the book. New book, new Paro, no Yosef. No memory, no, what's the word? There's no sense of an emotional attachment to Yosef, who did something for that society. And remember something about else about Yosef. The book of Bereshit ended at a place that we did not know what to do with Yosef. He very much had become ensconced within Egyptian society. And then, at the very last second, he says to his brothers, oh yeah, by the way, when you guys leave, I'm with you. I'm not staying over here. Essentially saying, don't build me a pyramid. Don't let them build me a pyramid. Don't let them embalm me or do whatever they do or mummify me or whatever they do. I'm not one of them, I'm one of you, and I want to go back home. I don't want to stay here. And that's an incredible statement. Rabbi Soloveitchik told over a story once about Edmund Rothschild. Many of you get to visit Zichron Yaakov. He's responsible for Zichron Yaakov, as he is for much of the wine trade in Israel. He was a very important, wealthy banker of the Rothschild family. He was the one who donated an incredible amount of money and resources to build up Israel. He died in 1934, was buried in France, and in 1954-55 or so, his will was completed when his children then took his body, dug it up from France, and buried him in Israel. That was his final request. It wasn't possible in the mid-30s. President of France, Charles de Gaulle, called up one of the Rothschilds and said, what's a good Frenchman? So he said, oh, a good Frenchman is somebody who contributes to society. Somebody follows the rules. Somebody follows the laws. Somebody respects and somebody. And de Gaulle said, you're correct, correct, correct. He goes, but I'll tell you what a good Frenchman is. A good Frenchman is somebody who's buried in the soil of France. Which means at that moment when Rothschild said, but I want to be buried in Israel, He eventually told his children, told anybody who would listen, anybody who cares. When it comes down to it, I am very loyal to France, but that's not who I am. Yaakov does this, and Yosef does this. With Yaakov, it's less surprising. Yosef, with all of the power that he had in Egypt, for his final request to be, I am not an Egyptian. I am a Jew, and I want to go back home. And by the way, this is one of the greatest moral requests that could be made. I'm saying the request on a moral level. He could turn to his brothers and his brothers' children and say, you kidnapped me from the land of Israel, and when the time comes, I want you to bring me back there. You have a moral responsibility of bringing me back to where you took me from. This is not just a last request. This is something which is the essence of morality. You have to fix what you broke. Yes, everything that happened was for the best. And yes, I had an unbelievable life over here. There was an unbelievable run in every single sense, in terms of honor, in terms of economics, in terms of political considerations. But when it comes down to it, I am not an Egyptian. I'm a Jewish boy who happened to have a job in the Egyptian government and not the other way around. And there's no room for confusion over here. And I'll say it again, that's how the book ends. And then when I read in the beginning of this book that there's a new Paro who doesn't know who Yosef is, of course he doesn't know who Yosef is. Because Yosef, who on every single right, economic right, he should have been on the echelon of the greatest Egyptian leaders. But Yosef asked not to be there. He asked not to be buried there. Or in de Gaulle's words, he wasn't a good Frenchman. And now in retrospect, of course he's not remembered. There is somebody who remembers, and that's the beautiful contrast. This is the first one that I want to point out. Yosef is also somebody who's described as having fear of God. When Yosef is all alone in a room with the woman who's hitting on him, and just for a moment's sake, let's just say she's attractive, and let's just say she's certainly willing, and she wants him, and as far as his career goes as a slave in that house, he will become a slave of favorite status, and his job will now be to make this woman happy. Many, many people will say, well, that sounds like a no-brainer. Why should I work hard out in the field or whatever else his job may have been when his job now can be to keep Mrs. Potiphar happy? But instead, Yosef says, but that would be a lack of respect in terms of my boss, your husband, and it would be a lack of respect to God. Yosef fears God, and he cannot sin when no one is watching. So I'm saying the contrast here is beautiful, that Paro doesn't remember Yosef, but over here the Mi'ilaldot, over here these women, the midwives, they do remember God, and maybe in therefore by extension they do somehow remember the morals of Yosef. To continue, I think the first secret of redemption is to truly believe that it's possible. Forget about it being possible. The belief that it's possible. I want to walk through the next couple of moments what happens, but first take a note of something. In the book of Bereshit, there were a number of women in important roles. Much of it was in terms of sexuality. A lot of it was in terms of victimhood. You can just go chapter after chapter after chapter to see this. Notice the book of Shemot begins with two women in a heroic role who defy Paro. That takes a great deal of bravery. And they're the ones who make sure that that blessing remains in the world. And what blessing is that? That's this blessing of Puravu remains. There will be a new generation of children. We'll make sure it. And as much as we can now, again, contrast. We could take Eve and blame Eve for death coming into the world, and because of Eve, people are going to die. But again, Pru Revu is the blessing, and the curse is the Eitz Hadat. And now you have people, somebody who lo yadat Yosef, lack of dat, because of this there's going to be death. And on the other hand, you have people who fear God, have Yirat Elokim, and because of them, life is going to continue because of their defiance of Paro. So over here, as much as we can blame Eve for death in the world, we can look at these two midwives who bring life into the world. Nonetheless, Paro continues with his insanity and says, fine, you don't want to kill them as soon as they're born, just take them and throw them to the Nile, which is something also that we need to understand. Why in the world would Paro think they won't kill them, but they'll throw them to the Nile? That's going to be part of understanding what Egypt is all about. But I'm pausing there, and I'm not going to explain yet why Paro would think that they would obey this, but they do. Beforehand, though, something interesting happens. V'yelech ish mi beit Levi, v'yikach et bat Levi. Batari isha, a man from the house of Levi married a woman, a daughter of Levi. V'yikach is a language of marriage. V'tahari isha v'teled ben, she became pregnant, she had a child. V'tereo to kitov, and she saw he was good. By the way, that's another echo from Bereshit. When God looks at all of the days of creation, it says, Zeh kitov, 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 kitov. Over here, looking at Yosef, there's kitov. Actually, this will explain the Midrash. The Midrash says that when Moshe is born, the house fills up with light. How do they know it fills up with light? What was the first thing in the beginning of Bereshit where God says kitov? It says, Vayahar kitov. God saw that the light was good. So over here, when look at Moshe, that's where it says that the house filled up with light because it's the same kitov, that it was good. Vatitzpaneo shlosha yirachim, and she hid him for 3 months. So I want to start with a question. Very simple question. We're going to learn later on that Moshe has two older siblings. Why does it tell us now that this man married this woman and they have a child when he married her way before this and they already had a daughter, they already had a son? These people are Moshe's parents, Amram and Yocheved, and there already is a Miriam and there already is an Aaron. Why does it say they get married? So the Talmud tells us something which is fascinating, which is going to fall directly in the theme of what we've already seen. It says that Amram decided to get divorced. He says it makes no sense to bring a child into the world when the child will be immediately killed. It is cruel. It is absurd to bring a child into the world in such circumstances. And then somebody stands up and she looks him in the eye and she says, "You're worse than Paro." And that person is Miriam. Miriam's daughter stands up and has this conversation with her father and says, "What are you doing? What are you talking about?" And the Gemara fills in some more pieces of information. It says Amram was a very influential person. And when he is separated from his wife, a lot of other people also got divorced. They said, "That's it. We're not bringing children to a world like this." And Miriam, and now here is another example of something which we've seen before. If you have it, then I'll introduce you to it. It's called the theory of conservation of characters. According to the Midrash, it's Miriam who's so concerned about bringing life into the world and about the lack of life. It says, therefore, she is one of the midwives. Because it's the same thing. Thematically, it's the same thing. And she turns to her father and says, "You're worse than Paro, because Paro only made a decree against the males. And because of you, there'll be no males and no females. No one will be born. Actually, following your plan, the Jewish people will come to an end, because there will be no more children, no more future, no more Jewish people." So it says then he got married, and that's this verse. There is a wonderful, beautiful comment in the Targum Yonatan later on. It says, because over here it says, a ben Levi and a bat Levi, somebody from the tribe of Levi married a daughter of Levi. Later on, it will say that Amram married Dodato, married, literally, it'd sound like his aunt, which, by the way, could trouble you or not trouble you. It doesn't trouble me at all, because it's before the Torah is given, so I don't have to worry about such things. We've heard in Bereshit worse things than this. But the Targum Yonatan translates the word Dodato in a Shir HaShirim kind of translation, where the word dod means lover. So it therefore says that, therefore Amram married Yocheved, Dodato, his lover, the woman that he loved. So what does it mean he married the woman that he loved, married his lover? He married his lover because they had already been married, and they divorced because they were afraid to bring children to the world. But somebody stood up and said, "No, you're worse than Paro." Right? So again, he marries Yocheved. I may have said that wrong before. Amram marries Yocheved because Miriam, his daughter, stood up and said, "You're worse than Paro." So what I'm pointing out then is that so far in terms of the text of the Torah, we have these two women who are heroic. It's interesting that in the opening and for the whole book of Bereshit, it was so much focused on males. When we now understand this rabbinic teaching, that the redemption of Egypt took place because of Nashim Tzadkaniyot, because of righteous women. And then there's some kinds of stories that, oh, they dressed up in the mirrors and so on. If you know all of those midrashim, wonderful. I'm not concerned with them now, because I don't have to work so hard, because I start with these two women in the text. the midwives, who have the fear of God and refuse to do what they're told to do by Paro. That takes a great deal of gumption. It takes a great deal of bravery. The second thing is a midrashic level, where it makes the hero Miriam. Now, why would the midrash make her the hero? Very, very simply. Let's go back to the text, because it's staring at us in the text. It's right here. All males have to be thrown into the river. Moshe is hidden for 3 months. By the way, the Kabbalists point out that Moshe is born Zayin Adar, so he's hidden for 3 months. That means that Moshe is revealed 3 months later, which is the sixth day of Sivan, which is the day of Matan Torah. That's when Moshe is revealed. That's when people really understand who Moshe is, and that's the day right now that Moshe is going to be thrown into the river. So that's really fascinating. Next time when we get to the holiday of Shavuot, to realize, okay, what happened in the holiday of Shavuot? Moshe was saved, was thrown into the river and saved from the river on the holiday of Shavuot. It's not just Matan Torah. It's a precursor to Matan Torah. It's the life. It is receiving life. And therefore, this can tell me something about the essence of the holiday Shavuot. It is receiving life, because on that day, Moshe receives life. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. They took Moshe, and we're told, and it's, I don't know if to say if it's beautiful or it's pathetic. I think it's more pathetic. They take him, they know he has to be put into the river. And again, the fact they obey is so frightening. But it says they put him in a little ark. So that's also interesting, because in the book of Bereishit, we had an ark. A teva, same word. And that teva was the teva which brought about salvation for Noach and ultimately for all of humanity. Now Moshe is placed in an ark, and what we're going to have, of course, is going to be a type of salvation. But it's over here that I want to read the text, because there's something over here which is just so beautiful and so different from everything that we've been used to till now. Vatasam bisuf al sfat ha'yor, and they put him inside this teva by the river. Vatetzav achoto. The word tetzav means to stand, but it means to stand firm. It means, you know, it's like you're standing so firm, somebody pushes you, you're not going to move. Vatetzav achoto merachok. She stands firm from afar. Lidea, and that same word used, that, to know, lidea. Maya selo, what's going to happen to him? So over here, again, I need to pause. I don't even begin to know which thing to hone on. I'll take one episode. Maybe the worst scene in Sefer Bereishit is when the brothers from afar see Yosef coming. You notice, by the way, we can't move far away from Yosef, and we won't be able to. The brothers from afar see Yosef is coming, and they start to conspire to kill him. Because even though he is their brother, there is no sense of brotherhood, and therefore they're willing to kill somebody who is their brother. Here is a girl, again, notice the difference, brothers, sister, new book, same story. I know that that may sound like I'm getting carried away. Same story, new book. Instead of a brother, it's a sister. Sister cannot take her eyes off of her brother. And those eyes most likely are crying. And those eyes most likely represent a heart which is broken. Because she's the one who insisted, according to the Midrash again, that her parents get back together. And they said, but why bring a child into the world who's going to die? And now, right in front of her, it's going to happen. This child is going to die. And she's watching this and she can't take her eyes off. And you have to ask yourself, what is this? So I think it's a combination of two things, and you can accuse me of getting carried away. One thing that it is caring. It's caring so much that I can't just turn around and walk away. You know, even metaphorically, when you say, you turned your back on your brother, it's a terrible thing. She can't turn her back on her brother. She can't turn away. This is a total representation of caring. But there may be a second element, and that is, encouraged the parents to get married in the first place, and it's one of hope. When he was born, the light filled up the house. Ki tov, he was good. It can't be. She just can't believe that this is it. He was brought into the world just to die. A life of 3 months, and that's it. And she watches. V'tered bat paro l'rchotz al hayam, and the daughter of Paro goes down to wash yourself by the river. And by the way, that's very disturbing. It really is. I know there's two ways of reading it, and you can choose which one you like. One way of reading it is, how insensitive is this woman, Bat Paro? This is the place that all the Jewish babies are thrown into the water. This is where she has to bathe? On the other hand, if you want to read it as a positive level, and there is a midrashic theme that goes this way, that she wants to go to the mikveh. She wants to purify herself. She wants to separate herself from all of the corruption that is all around her. So as I said, you can do it, read it either way, but for me it's just so strange to go to this place. And she goes in to the river, Vatera et ha-teva, and they see the ark, Bitol chasuf, Vatishlach ha-matah v'tikachea, and they bring the child, Vatiftach, they open up the ark, Vatireo ta-yeled, and they see that there's a child there, V'ninar bocheh, and the lad, the boy, is crying. And here is going to be the incredible shift. Vatachmol alav, and she had compassion for him. Vatomer, miyodei avrim zeh. And she has no illusion. She knows exactly why there was a child in the river, in the Nile. It's a Jewish kid. Those are the kids that are thrown in the Nile. So she sees there's a Jewish kid. And then Miriam does something, which again is possible. That's the theory of conservation of characters. She does something which is so brave. Vatomer achoto al bat paroha elech v'karati lach ishami neket min avriot v'tinik lach et hayeled. And she's standing and watching this from afar, and she says, do you want me to bring one of the Jewish servants to nurse this child for you? And by the way, I hope you all realize, to find a nurse, there could have been other people to nurse. The Midrashim say that Moshe wouldn't nurse. He kept chol of Yisrael. We don't need a nurse from a Jewish woman, right? He would not nurse from anyone else. But again, that's not the simple reading of the text. The simple reading of the text is that Miriam walks in and says, I'll find you a nurse. And Bat Paro agrees. V'tomu l'Bat Paro, lechi, go. Miriam goes and calls the mother of the child. She calls her mother. She calls Yocheved. And Bat Paro says, listen, I want to make a deal. Take this child home with you and nurse him until he no longer needs to be nursed. I'm going to pay you. When she takes him to nurse. Do any of you realize what we just now read? I want to go back to this mother. Earlier in this day, she had the most traumatic day, most traumatic morning of her life. She nursed a child for 3 months and then knew that this child's life is in danger and all of their lives are in danger if they keep him there. And they make a decision, which we could debate in our other class if it's a moral decision or not a moral decision. They take this child, put him inside, don't directly kill him, but put him inside a teva and put him in the river following the letter of the law. And she that morning, I'll say it again, she probably fell into deep depression knowing that she was just now responsible for bringing a life into this world which could not be sustained, and now she was actively involved in passively putting the child in a situation where the child would be dead very quickly. And early in this morning, when she let go of the child for the last time, and she cried, and she knew that she would never see him again, she would never hold him again, she would never nurse him again, and she cried for the life that would never be. And do you understand what this means? There's a phrase which I love. Yeshuat Hashem keheref ayin. The salvation of God is like the blink of an eye. A situation which is impossibly dire, a situation which is absolutely irredeemable, total death written all over it, skull and crossbones and so on. That's leading into the scene. The music in the background of the scene has to be the most frightening, depressing music that there is. As Moshe is led into the river, and then within, snap of the finger, blink of the eye, whatever you want to call it, the mother is called by the daughter of Paro and offered money to be paid, a slave, to be paid to do the very thing that she wants to do more than anything in this world at this moment. And suddenly she gets her child back, and she's being paid, and she's holding him again, and she's nursing him, and suddenly redemption is possible. God had promised all those years ago to Avraham, you're going to be enslaved, you're going to be taken advantage of, and one day you're going to leave Beruchush Gadol, you're going to leave with a great deal of wealth, and at that moment, what we call in Kabbalistic terminology, Bezir Anpin, The English is easier. A microcosm. A microcosm of all of redemption just now took place. Going from death to life, going from poverty to being paid, going from an impossible situation to suddenly a solution. And suddenly we realize that God is truly in back of this scene, watching this, pulling strings, making sure that this child is born to this family, but doing something else as well. God is guaranteeing that this child now is going to be taken back into the house of Paro. He's going to receive the best education that money could buy. And by the way, Paro is going to pay for the tuition. And Moshe is going to be brought up, and he's going to be educated, and he's going to be see firsthand what leadership is. And by the way, both in terms of success and failures. And Moshe is going to be primed to one day be leader. I'll put it this way, the man who will be king. And it's interesting, because I said we can't let go of Yosef. Yosef is somebody who also was brought into the house of Paro and achieves a level of leadership. And over here, he's in the palace, and he's in the palace. There is something, therefore, which is just very interesting. Of course, Yosef was hidden. Sofnat Paneach, nobody knows who he is. But Moshe also is hidden, because they're claiming that Moshe is the child of Bat Paro, and therefore he deserves all rights and privileges of growing up in the palace. But I want to again focus on one thing. The hero in this story until this point were these two anonymous women, or semi-anonymous, Shifra and Pua. There are these two women who are the midwives. We then have, on the midrashic level, the sister of Moshe, Miriam. And then in the text itself, the sister of Moshe, who can't turn her back on her brother, just like so many people did in the book of Bereshit. I mean, after all, what is the book of Bereshit if not a book about dysfunctional families that brothers can't get along with one another? From the very beginning of the book, brothers trying to kill one another, to the very end of the book, brothers trying to kill one another. And over here, we have a new book, a new beginning. And just, I hope you appreciate the beauty of the shift over here, because it's not just brothers. Maybe that was the solution all along. Maybe we needed to give women more of a role over here, because as soon as the sister of Moshe gets involved, instead of a situation of sibling rivalry trying to kill the other one, and who's going to be in charge and who's going to be the bechor, we suddenly find a completely different dynamic of a sister who cannot turn her back on her brother, because that is absurd, and instead she becomes the vehicle for redemption by having the gumption to walk over to Bat Paro and say, I will find someone to nurse for you. And she goes and finds the mother of this child, and this mother and child reunion, to borrow a line from Paul Simon, that we have over here, this reunion, which seemed, again, just a moment ago, earlier in the day, this seemed impossible. They were mourning his death, and suddenly Moshe is back alive again. And not only is Moshe going to be alive, but the trajectory of Moshe's life now is going to take a direction that nobody possibly could have anticipated. And now Moshe is going to enter into the palace. I don't know how long he stays with his mother. I do know what she said to him. I don't know how long he stayed. If she's being paid to nurse him, do you say, well, listen, nursing's a pain, I'll stop as soon as possible and give the child over? Or do you say that every day that I nurse him, I keep him alive, I keep him with me, and maybe she'll be willing to nurse him longer? I don't know. What I can tell you is that children that are nursed are generally much healthier than children who are not nursed. That antibodies from the mother's body go into the child. There's many, many elements of health which are correlated to longer nursing. In antiquity, they would nurse children 3 years, 4 years. I don't know how long he was nursed. I don't know when he was given up, but I do know what she taught him. Part of it I can make up, but part of it I know. Which part do you want first? The part I'll make up or the part that I know? The point I make up is that she told him, you're going to be raised in the palace, but you're not the first one raised in the palace. A long time ago, you had a great-great-great uncle. His name was Yosef. He lived in the palace, and he was a tzaddik. By the way, that's really important, because this is the family of Levi now, talking about Yosef. Levi never got along with Yosef. Family of Levi, the ones who wanted to kill Yosef. And now the family of Levi are saying, once upon a time, he had a great-great-uncle, and he was a tzaddik, and he took care of all of the Jewish people. One second. That is incredibly important. That part I almost know. Instead of making it up, but I almost know that. Why am I saying that? We'll see in a second. You had a great uncle whose name is Yosef. He was brought up in the palace. He lived in the palace. And from the palace, he used his abilities to take care of the Jewish people. He gave them food. He gave them jobs. He gave them clothing. He gave them everything that they needed. And he did this for around 80 years, more or less, give or take. One of the reasons I say this is when the Jews left Egypt the night before they leave, maybe we'll come back to this another week. It says that all the Jews, right before they leave that night, they go all running to borrow gold and silver and all kinds of things. But Yosef, we're told that night, goes and looks for the remains of Yosef, and Moshe carries out the remains of Yosef. So when I say that I think that there's this incredible fidelity, relationship, caring between Yosef and Moshe, or Moshe and Yosef, to be more precise, I think it's real. I think that it's there. By the way, there's another woman who's part of the whole secret here. This is Midrashic. The Midrash says, but Moshe couldn't find where Yosef was. They buried him someplace, going to one into the Nile. So there was an old woman. This old woman, her name was Serach Bat Asher. Serach Bat Asher. That means Asher, one of the 12 tribes, had a daughter named Serach. She is this woman, she is, how shall we put this? She is the redemption whisperer. You know, they got all kinds of whisperers who know secrets. She knows secrets. I'll tell you something about her when she was much younger, also Midrash, but first now as an old woman. Moshe wants to know, where is Yosef? And they say, go ask Serach. She's, you know, the oldest one here. You know, like in every family, there's this old woman, the matriarch, who knows all the things and all the stories from the previous generations. So it's fascinating the Midrash focuses on Serach as far as this possessor of knowledge and the one who knows about redemption. She actually, there are three elements about redemption about her. One is, and this is one now, well, when Moshe comes and sees the people and says, God sent me, and they don't know to believe him or not, we're told that all the elders of the Jewish people, they go over to Serach, and they said, some guy came, and he can turn the staff into a snake and a serpent and whatever does this. And she, like, all the miracles, she goes like this. And then he says, and he said the following. He said, Pakod Pakadati. That God said, the time is that I'm going to redeem you. And she said, he said, Pakod Pakadati? He's the guy. That's my tradition. My tradition is that the fellow who comes and says those two words, that's the magic, those are the magic words. She's the only one who knows it. So it says that the Jews did not believe in Moshe as the Redeemer until they asked Serach Bat Asher, and she's the one who said, yeah, he's the guy. And then all the years later, we'll see how long the redemption process took, but when they're actually ready to leave, Moshe comes over to Serach and says, where's Yosef? And she tells him exactly where to find Yosef. Serach, when she was a girl, she was the one who had a very important job. She took care of Yaakov. When the brothers, there's another midrash. Well, the Serach midrashim now. There's another couple, but these are the main ones. That when Serach came, when the brothers came back from Egypt, and now they know that Yosef is alive, and they have to tell Yaakov, they're terrified. How exactly do you tell Yaakov that his son is alive? And they were afraid that Yaakov would have a heart attack. They were afraid that he would die on the spot. So let me read to you the Midrash. She ends up living an incredibly long life. I cannot tell you how old she is. Yeah, so I'm quoting right now from the Midrash HaGadol, which is a Midrash that they found in the Geniza in Cairo. V'yagid lo lemor od Yosef chai. They wanted to tell him that Yosef is still alive. Is Yosef? Rabbanan amru, imano omru lo, tchila Yosef, kayam, shema tefrach nishmato. If we just go over to Yaakov and say straight off, oh, by the way, Yosef is still alive, they're afraid that he would have a heart attack and die. Ma'asu, what did they do? Omru lo Serach bat Asher. And they said to Serach, by the way, sometimes in Midrashim her name is with a sin and sometimes with a samach. So anybody looking for all information will only find half if you look for the spelling one way or the other. Amri lavinu Yaakov, she Yosef kayam v'hum Mitzrayim. You're the one entrusted to tell him. Ma'asta, what did she do? Imtina lo ad shehu omed b'tfila. She waited till Yaakov was praying. V'amra b'lashon tema. And then she said, sort of with a question mark at the end, and I want you all to imagine that she did this with a tune. She was humming this. This is not a rap, by the way, because rap is not music, but she did this as singing, and she said as following, Yosef b'mitzrayim, yodu lo arba b'kayim, Menashe v'Ephraim. She said, Yosef is alive, Yosef is in Egypt, and Yosef has had a couple of kids, and their names are Menashe and Ephraim. And she's singing this in the background, humming this in the background, and saying these words as Yaakov is praying. And instead of getting the sudden shock, Yaakov is experiencing this feeling, by the way, of redemption. It's the same theme again. It's this theme of thinking that somebody is dead and then realize that they're alive. That's this theme that happens to Moshe. It's this theme that happens in terms of Yosef. So therefore, this experience, this near-death experience as it was, but realize now that not only is this theme, this idea that women are a part of the redemption, you now realize you could put a name to it. You put a name to it, it's Miriam. It's Yocheved. It's Serach. They're all a part of this song of redemption, as it were, being the ones who believe in the redemption and being the ones who facilitate the redemption and being the ones who bring it from one generation to the next. So I'm saying all of this is, in my mind, is fascinating in terms of this subtext of Bereishit. Again, subtext in terms of Shemot. Bereishit was a book where brothers can't get along with one another because of a lack of sense of brotherhood, and here you have a girl who cannot turn her back on her brother. Now, I said that while his mother is educating him, there's a couple things going on in terms of this conversation. And maybe education is a funny word. Maybe you think education doesn't take place until your college age. I don't know at which time you think education is possible. But education takes place at every single stage. And again, I told you, I have no doubt that Moshe's mother said certain things to him. Now I'll tell you what I know that she said. Till now I said my suspicion. I'll tell you what I know she said. She said, one, you are a Jew. You're not an Egyptian. Again, you can ask me how I know that. You'll see soon. She probably also tells him that God must have a purpose, and the reason that you're going to be in the palace is to do something. And the reason why I say this, it says, Vayigdal ha-yeled, he grows up, Vativiehu lebat paro. And at that point, he's brought back to Bat Paro. Vila Leven, and he becomes a son for her. Vatikrashmo Moshe. And she calls him Moshe, and she says, Vatomer, ki minamayim mishitihu, because I took him out of the water. Which is actually quite fascinating, because she seems to be admitting where she found him, how she found him. But she's actually doing something really important, but I'll see if I have time to get back to it. And then days went by. Vayigdal Moshe. Moshe is described two times as having grown up. First he grew up. Vayigdal Yeled, he's taken to Paro. Now Vayigdal Yeled. Vayetze El Echav. Translate, he goes out to his brothers. Vayar Bisivlotam. And he sees their suffering. So right there, pause. You would have thought that a man raised in the palace as an Egyptian, the son of the Egyptian princess, grandson of Paro, his own self-definition should have been that he perhaps is in line to become Pharaoh one day. He is an Egyptian. He's Egyptian royalty. But that's not what it says. It says he goes out, Vayetze El Echav. There's a purpose to him going out. He goes out to see his brothers. He knows those are his brothers. Vayar Besivlotam. Instead of being raised as an Egyptian, saying a Jewish slave deserves to get smacked every now and again. You see a Jew, he's okay, why is that Jew, you know? It's obvious if you self-identify as an Egyptian, but he doesn't. He sees these are his brothers. He sees their pain. Vayar ish mitzri makeh yishivri me'echav. And he sees an Egyptian hitting one of his brothers. So Jin just realized Moshe's mother accomplished something in those years that she had nursing him. She infused within him an identification as being a Jew. That's who I am. What happens next is incredible. V'yifin kol v'cho, he looks left and right. V'yar ki ein ish, he sees no one. V'yachet to mitzri, and he beats the mitzri, v'tmeinu b'chol, and he buries him within the dirt, or the hole in the sand. He buries him in the sand. So I want you to appreciate what we just now read. The beginning of Bereshit, remember I said from the start today that we want to do a comparison and a contrast? Bereshit began with one brother killing another brother because of no sense of brotherhood. Cain kills Hevel because he doesn't feel that Hevel is really a brother or has any value to his life. Moshe kills an Egyptian because the Egyptian is hitting his brother, who's not literally his brother. Which means I have to read these two episodes one against the other. But one, Cain killing Hevel, is because of a lack of sense of brotherhood when it's literally a brother. And over here, Moshe hitting the abusing Egyptian, or the Egyptian who abuses somebody who he feels is his brother, even though he's not literally his brother, which means now you realize how different this book is going to be. Bereshit begins with a lack of sense of brotherhood, which will carry throughout the book. And Shemot begins with an act of defense of a brother because it's my brother, which means actually now you realize it's the second act like this. And again, if I'll ask, where does Moshe get this from, that you don't turn your back on your brother, then I can say maybe it's the education that he received from somebody, a little girl, and you know her name already. Her name is Miriam. Because Miriam is the one who taught you don't turn your back on your brother. And it's not just words, because that's why Moshe's in the world. Moshe's in the world because of Miriam on two different levels. One is because she said to her parents, you can't separate, you have to go back together. And that's Vayikach Ishmi Beit Levi, V'kachet Bat Levi. That they got married again demonstrably because their daughter said, you need to get together and show people that there is hope. But then afterwards, it looked like there was no hope anymore. But she refused to believe that there was no hope, and she would not turn her back on her brother. Which means the hero of the story is most certainly Miriam, who can't turn her back on her brother. And now that would be so beautiful. This is this trickle-down morality, which now has infused Moshe as well, because Moshe now has grown up in a house learning responsibility. You don't turn your back on your brother. You take responsibility. Now, I want to go back for a moment. Why is Moshe called Moshe? Moshe is called Moshe because he was born of the Nile. Earlier, what I said is that it seemed absurd. Pharaoh said, kill all the males, and they don't want to kill them. Okay, so take them and throw them in the river. Why would they acquiesce? So this is very difficult for us to understand because we're rationalists. In Egypt, they believed that the Nile was a life force. It was alive. The god of the Nile was Pharaoh himself. This is going to be the introduction to Egyptian mythology. But if you don't realize that the Nile is alive to them, you can't understand almost anything moving forward in terms of the plagues. They refused to kill the children themselves, so Pharaoh said, fine, throw the child into the Nile, and the Nile, which is alive, will determine and decide who lives and who dies. So what does Bat Pharaoh say? The Nile gave birth to this child. Which means she's claiming that Moshe is a god, just like Pharaoh is a god. And again, that is so foreign to us, so difficult for us, but that's what she's doing. So therefore, Moshe's cover story in the palace is he's Moshe. There's no embarrassment at his name. He was given birth by the Nile. He is a god. But what's going to happen as soon as he kills the Egyptian? And by the way, the next day he goes out, he sees Jews fighting. Do you realize how that breaks his heart? He goes, how could he hit one another? You guys are Jews. You know, sometimes Balei Tshuva, people not brought up in the Jewish community, have wonderful imaginations of how Jews are so nice to one another until they actually see it. And it breaks their heart. What? I thought the Jews get along with one another all the time. That's what happens to Moshe. He's not born within the community, so he has a certain tradition, he has certain beliefs, he has certain imagination, hopes, and he sees the Jews are hitting one another. Vayomer, mi samcha l'ish sar v'shofet aleinu? Who put you in charge? Who made you the judge? By the way, according to tradition, these two fellows, Adat and Avira, and later on in the story of Korach, are going to say to Moshe, who put you in charge? The exact same words. He says, you're going to kill us the same way that you killed the Mitzrim? And Moshe was frightened because they're basically threatening him. We're going to tell on you. Paro heard about this, which means these guys went over and told people. They went and spread the word that Moshe killed an Egyptian. And at that point, it became revealed to everybody that Moshe was not really an Egyptian god. Moshe is just a Jew who was wearing Egyptian clothing, who was brought up in the palace, and now Moshe's life is in danger. But I want to appreciate something. When it says, again, this is a little deep, but it's easy. It says that Moshe looks one way and he looks the other way. Vayachet haMitzri, and he kills the Egyptian. Realize something. The Egyptian that he killed was an Egyptian prince named Moshe. Out of this emerged somebody new, and the person who emerged is somebody named Moshe, who happens to be our greatest leader. Which means at that moment, when Moshe sides with the Jews against the Egyptians, and you can say it would have been a great career move for him to ignore the fight, listen, you know, guys, try to behave and go back into the palace. But the moment he sides with the Jews against the Egyptians, again, Paro is going to want to kill him for this. At this moment, Moshe's career as an Egyptian prince, the prince of Egypt, has come to an end. From this moment forward, Moshe is now going to spend a lot of time as a refugee, as a fugitive, as somebody who has to run away. Let's recap what we've done today. You guys have strength for 5 more minutes or no? When I said in the very beginning that the Jews were told sunk to the 49th level of Tumah, were told that they gave up almost everything. They said they stopped doing circumcision. The Midrash says that. They said, let's be like the Egyptians. They wanted to acculturate. That's the story of exile. You want to fit into the culture. So we're told the Jews changed everything, and now there's a bunch of different Midrashim. Most of them say that they kept their names, and they kept their language. There's even the way it's reported is they kept their clothing, which, by the way, is 99% a Hasidic interpolation into this idea, because keeping levush in Hasidic sources is incredibly important. But that's the way that this is remembered by the community, is that the Jews kept those things. Moshe does not have an Egyptian, doesn't have a Jewish name. He has an Egyptian name. Not only does he have an Egyptian name, his name is part of Egyptian theology or mythology. He's born of the Nile. Which means the Jews are going to be eventually saved and not completely assimilate, because they keep their names and they keep their language. It's also they keep the secret belief that one day they'll be redeemed. Moshe for himself doesn't have Egyptian clothing. He's raised in the palace. Doesn't have an Egyptian name. Doesn't even speak the language. Most likely that's why he protests when God says, you'll go and speak to Paro. And he says, but I'm Aral Sfatayim. My language is a foreign language. How can I represent the Jews? But God did something really fascinating here. He chose the person who, on one level, was the least likely individual to redeem them, because he is the most assimilated person. He's the most assimilated Jew. He literally grows up in the palace. So we again get this incredible dichotomy. The Jews, despite losing almost everything, are saved because they keep their names, keep their clothing, keep their language, even though they may lose their religion. That's important. Moshe, I think, keeps his religion, but he loses everything else, and he keeps his belief. The implications of Moshe as Messiah, I want to use that word specifically, as Redeemer, is so counterintuitive. Because if you ask people today, oh, what kind of person would be the Messiah? You would say the person who is the greatest tzaddik, the person who's the most involved in Judaism. Yet the person who saved us in Egypt was the person who God handpicked, placed inside the palace, placed within the corruption of the society, and he emerges from that place. I think part of the reason is, for the Jews to be saved, when you're a slave, not only do you get acculturated, you believe in the mythology. The Jews believed in this stuff as well, because you can't help it. By the way, let's be honest. All of us are assimilated, not just our clothing, and not just most of us, our names. It seeps into your pores in ways that you can't even possibly protect yourself, and that's what it means to grow up in a society which is an open society. There are good things about it and there are terrible things about it. In order for the Jews to believe that the whole Egyptian mythology is false, you needed somebody to walk out of that mythology and say, I've seen Paro. You're right. He puts on one shoe and then the other shoe, or he goes to the bathroom like everybody else. He's a human being. I've seen him. We've joked around. I know him. The whole thing is a fake. You know, it's like that most wonderful scene in the history of movies, second most, same movie, Wizard of Oz, when they look behind the curtain and you see that's the wizard over there. That's the wizard. Yeah, it's just some guy. This great wizard of Paro of Egypt is just a guy. And they believe he's a god because you can't help but believe he's a god. Who better than somebody who used to be a god himself, born of the Nile, part of the mythology, to walk out and to say, there is only one God, and that's the God of Israel. And how does Moshe know this? Well, Moshe knows this because his mother kept telling him this every single day. Because his mother, just like Serach bat Asher whispered to Yaakov Avinu, his mother whispers this in his ear every single day. His mother tells him and believe, and there's a God. He's going to redeem us, and you're going to be involved in this. And you can't ever forget who you are. You can't forget your identity. You can't forget that your brothers are out over here. And how do we know that she did a great job? Because Moshe walks outside, and he has this sense of brotherhood. He has a profound sense of brotherhood. And Moshe never loses that sense of brotherhood. And that's something which Moshe got from his mother, and he got it from his sister. And let's not forget, because the hero of this week's Parsha is a little girl, and a little girl's name is Miriam, who midrashically tells her parents, you can't break up, you have to get back together. But forget about the midrash and the text itself. Unlike the brothers of Yosef, who plot his murder and turn their back on him, she somehow believes that he will be saved, and she cannot turn her back on her brother. So that's the hero of the story. Right there, redemption comes possible. And how do we know redemption comes possible? Because it happened with one person. One person was redeemed. Who felt it? Eim habanim smecha. And that's the word which is used. Eim habanim smecha. The mother of the child was happy when she gets Moshe back in her arms and she gets paid to nurse him. She gets paid to do the things she wants to do more than anything else. At that moment, she knows anything is possible. Moshe is brought up believing in the impossible is possible, which means Moshe is going to be the one to walk us out and tell us, yes, redemption is possible. How do you know redemption is possible? And Moshe will say, listen, I had a near-death experience. And the secret of redemption, the first step of redemption, is to know something, and that is that we need to have a completely different book than we had before. Because that book ends up as a failure because brothers can't get along. This book is going to be very different because brothers are getting along. And the first person who teaches us how important it is that brothers are going to get along is this little girl named Miriam, who cannot turn her back on her brother.